I'll break the ice. Amanda Steele from Insurance Australia Group. My question is specifically to Natalie. Natalie, I was wondering what priorities Fosters has identified for their CSR program and how they've gone about identifying what those priorities are with their stakeholders.
In two sentences or less. The biggest problem that I think we've experienced in defining our CSR agenda, if you like, is actually trying to put boundaries around it. Because if you accept that it is basically management of non-market risks and capturing non-market opportunities, it can go on forever. And if you're talking about the practical edge of that being changing the way that we do HR or procurement or operations, you know, what are the edges of that thing? I mean, it's really quite, it's basically the whole of the business. So I think we've been a little intuitive, to be honest. I don't think we've tried too much to confine it to a holy list or a sort of, you know, we've allowed it to sort of develop in line with priorities. But look, I guess the short answer is projects tend to prioritise themselves either through disaster, imminent disaster, and urgency, or through passionate and committed people who've got the ability to drive something at a business level, or through what else? There's a mix of probably random and strategic, you know, sort of elements. It's very hard to describe in a paragraph. I hope that helps. Probably not.
Natalie, hello. My name's Sarah Kennington. I'm from the Benevolent Society. I guess one of the big social issues around alcohol is the growth of binge drinking. And I just wondered what Fosters, all the alcohol industry, were doing about that.
Again, all these very technical and small contained questions. No, thanks for the question. Where to start? Firstly, we're completely aware of, I guess, the problem. We certainly don't have a denial sort of attitude either as Fosters or the industry in general. You know, there's a whole range of things that we're doing, and I don't want to descend into PR land and start reciting things at you, but I think the key point really is that we play a role that is relevant to and addresses what we can do as a company. We're not the government, we're not parents, we're not retailers. There's a lot of levers that go into this sort of, you know, the whole of the story that we simply can't get near. And so we acknowledge that. And we don't try and pretend, you know, that we can sort of save the world on this issue. So we try and pick appropriate responses, pressure points at which, as producers, we can make a difference. Things like lower alcohol drinks, things like including non-alcohol in all of our sponsorship agreements, things like responsible raising the bar on our responsible advertising code, enhanced information on bottles for consumers around alcohol content. So, you know, I think that we take a fairly a very honest, a very open, but also a very pragmatic approach, saying these are the levers that we can pull as producers, and these are the things that we would be grandstanding and we would be lying if we said that we're going to be able to sort of do on behalf of the rest of the actors, if you like, in the issue. Does that answer your question?
I'll give Natalie a break. Matt Morris from Transgrid. Christine, I'm just interested in asking a question about where the driver for CSR comes from your organisation. I think many of us in the room here would recognise, due to either regulatory requirements or good corporate citizen requirements, that moving down a path of CSR is probably favourable. But for your company, where does the driver come from? And is it internal staff or is it someone in the executive?
I think many companies have their road to Damascus, sort of, you know, bolt of lightning that comes out of the sky. And we're sort of saying for some companies it happened a bit earlier in the mining sector, Octeti and BHP. For our company, it was actually a little problem we had with a mercury spill, although we'd actually dealt with it very well technically in Peru, and it had affected four different villages. In one particular village, we just didn't manage, and I think it's a tough discussion internally, but we've ended up now with a huge multi-million dollar cost, an ongoing reputational issue. It, I think, from the company's perspective, took the kind of emerging, doing good things in communities programs that had happened quite a lot. I mean, miners, example, we have a quite large mine in Indonesia where we have built and staffed and provide all the books to 14 schools in the surrounding area. It's not uncommon for miners to, I mean, really significant. I mean, I think we've been, quite frankly, can claim to have made a significant contribution to the eradication of malaria in that area because of the funding from the company. So there have been a whole lot of fantastic programs, and I think in your own companies you'd often find that, that at a corporate level from the board down, actually looking at the business risk elements, I think it actually really came back to 2000 when it was, even though Newmont had already been involved in the Global Mining Initiative, that was certainly a huge driver to start looking at our own internal skill base. And it moved it from how do we actually find people that can go and sort out those people out there to actually saying this is a fundamental issue of leadership within the company, it's an issue of skills and capacity building, we actually need to get better at the kind of technical base. And I'd have to say, you know, it scares me when I go to mine sites and they'll kind of introduce the community relations person and say their heart's in the right place. And so I like to joke now, well, that's not actually a formal qualification. You often kind of think if you had the mill manager being introduced or the finance manager as someone with their heart in the right place, you'd probably be starting to get a bit worried. So I think for us it's actually tried to move it from a cottage industry approach to it, to say we have to start applying the same sort of business disciplines that we do in other areas and understand there's a technical skill base to this stuff, that whether it's environmental science, you know, for our industry where we were with safety 20 years ago, in the social and the other political areas, we actually just need to get better at it. And that's hard when people, at one level, you know, we kind of joke that community relations used to be funding the footy club and having the logo on, you know, the footy club tops in local communities. Actually being able to ask the question of where the risks lie, build it into a bigger sort of program, and although all of us belong to community organisations, also recognising there are specialists and there is a technical kind of expertise that sits around it. And I think we're making headway. But certainly, you know, more recent than you imagine that happened, even though at a general level, and I reckon if you talked to a lot of companies who are driving CSR, they've probably got something in their history that finally made the board go, ouch.
Hi, Kate Frost from the Smith family. I guess more of a general discussion, no specifically pointed questions, which is probably good timing at this point. One of the things that not-for-profits a hearing as an industry, I think, is the need to be more business focused, to be able to provide our partners with a return on investment and be very efficient and effective in the way we use funds. And certainly that makes sense. On the other side of it, some of the feedback that we get is we're losing our hearts, that we're not community based enough, that we don't, you know, we're not heartfelt as much as we would, and we lose some of that. And I guess my question to you is, how do we manage that? I mean, we understand we need to be effective in the use of funds, we have to be disciplined and build partnerships. How do we lose the heart stuff, the hearts and the engagement on that side?
Look, I actually think for the community sector, probably some of those debates started with the outsourcing by government of actually getting into contractor funding relationship with community organisations has actually driven exactly the same debate. I guess my own view is that in areas of high social need, and certainly in my time when I was CEO of a health department, I honestly felt that when you've got massive demand and not enough resources to go around, you actually need to be more efficient and more kind of successful in doing the basic business stuff. And I don't actually see them as in conflict with one another. I think there's a huge language gap. And I certainly, you know, some of the more kind of torrid debates I have with, you know, friends and former colleagues, because I've spent some time in the NGO sector too, is around, you know, my argument that there has to be a business return. But yet for me, that's a sustainability argument. And I would have thought from a community sector perspective, if you can't see the value to the community in doing it, then you'd have to ask exactly the same question. So some of it, I think, is terminology. I'd hate to take the passion out of it, but then I kind of like to think I can indulge in passion in the business sector too. So it's, I think it's terrible if we actually don't have people who care about what they do and are really engaged with it. But I'm not sure why that's in opposition to being disciplined and successful at actually managing what you're meant to manage. So.
David Williams from Ernst & Young. Christine, you mentioned sustainability as being a big issue. And in the context of gold mining, You mentioned a couple of issues about education and the health of the communities that you're working in. It seems to me that those are two important aspects, but they're not going to drive the sustainability for those communities. And gold mining is there for a short time in mining terms. What other things do you do for the communities specifically to help drive the sustainability for them?
Well, given that we find ourselves caught up, whether we like it or not, in this huge debate about the sustainability of remote Aboriginal communities and remote communities more generally. I mean, our population base in Australia is so small. How do you actually look after communities or see a future for 800 people? Or the Yanganu pictured in Jarrahlands, 3,000 people spread across a huge area in multiple very small communities. I think there's a bigger question than just for mining. But certainly I think for us, I mean, it's making me really think again about some of our more glib statements about we'll leave a sustainable legacy in communities that, you know, host our mines. And I keep thinking, why do we keep saying that? Because I think what we have to ask is what is reasonable in terms of the economic opportunity that we present? Because that is what we present. We present real jobs in the real economy. And if communities actually lack one thing, that's what they lack. You know, in fact, the mining sector is the biggest employer of Aboriginal Australians that's not in Indigenous affairs. So basically, we employ more people in real jobs than anywhere else. So the question then is, how do you define that in terms of that using it as a platform, which is why we think health status, education, infrastructure. So if we're putting in water treatment or roads, can we do that in a way where the community may be able to build up a skill base in doing road maintenance that you'd see as part of an ongoing kind of regional development or local government role? And can we provide lower tech answers that might actually be able to survive us leaving? And I honestly think we're a bit better at that in other parts of the world. So there are examples of sort of low tech engagement with community in places like, you know, Asia and Africa, that it's interesting to say, why aren't we applying the same thinking in the Australian context? It's not a very neat answer, but I genuinely believe, I mean, there's a really great study that actually said that for every additional year of education of a woman, for a woman's life, her child is more likely to survive another five. It's a really powerful statistic when you think about it. And for communities that have got the sort of stats I put up, you know, dying 20 years earlier, incredibly high levels of infant mortality, then I'd actually think, how could you, an investment in education, infrastructure and employability feels like that's actually got more chance of being a sustainable legacy than building something. And we know people love to build something and they love opening ribbons and all that kind of stuff. But actually investing in the human infrastructure is, for me, a part of the future legacy.
Hi there, Craig Johnston from EDS Australia. I'm interested in understanding a little bit more about the HR side of the attractiveness of CSR. So have you found with establishing the programs within your companies that people are interested these days in terms of employment? Is this something that you can sell to the people, prospective employees? Is it more prevalent in the younger people of today than it is in the older people that you're looking to employ? Thanks.
Well, this is the generation X, Y and Z and wherever we've kind of got to now. I can answer from our perspective, and we know that we're in a highly competitive labour market, and all the things that actually drive our interest in Indigenous employment or gender diversity also are exactly the same issues that we believe that a mining company has to actually answer the question of, would I feel okay telling my boyfriend, girlfriend, mother, father, grandparent that I work for you? And we actually are really trying to understand what that means. And I think ethical behaviour, I mean, the notion, in effect, the way the labour market works is we don't breed kind of loyalty. People know that they, very bright people, are actually very movable commodities. And so I think that, as you know, wages are part of it. But what we're getting back from all our HR people is that you need to be competitive in terms of the dollars, and if you're not, you're not even in the game. But beyond that, it is a whole lot of other intangible things about the culture of the company, the capacity to feel good about what you do, as well as opportunities for advancement that affect it. So it seems to me that CSR is right in the middle of that, and it's certainly affecting our HR and recruitment policies.
Yes, is the answer for Fosters. In fact, employees are the most significant target group, if you like, of the program part of our CSR activity. So what would sort of be traditional CSR stuff, charity support and engagement and that sort of thing. It's all built around our employees, and we did we went to a lot of trouble to survey them and do focus groups and the like in building that part of the CSR profile, if you like. But I should just note that we're talking here about, you know, Australia, the UK, New Zealand and the United States and a couple of other markets for Fosters. The situation in our Asian operations was completely different. So it is very culturally loaded. I mean, when we went to our then brewery in Shanghai, which is no longer part of the group, and talked to them about this, they were appalled at the thought that the company could be giving money to community organisations and charities, because culturally the feedback we got was that's our job as individuals and as families, and we look after our own, and your job, if you've got any spare money, you can pay us more and we'll give more sort of further down. So it is very, I just caution that, yes, but it is in our experience anyway still more of a sort of an Anglo, you know, Western Europe type cultural plus, and it's a negative in other markets, HR markets for us.
Yeah, I mean, I'd echo similar things. I think the content of what you do may be quite different, but certainly for us in Ghana, it's been a big issue about how people feel about working in the company, and that's as much, and I know in Indonesia for us, one of the big issues was how people felt about the reputation of the company around environmental performance. So it wasn't sort of social programs or giving, but the need to have confidence about the technical kind of sophistication of our environmental management and being sure of what it looks like, because the feedback we were getting very clearly is people were actually at home being asked about, is it okay? And in that was a really interesting experience where the issues that we've been dealing with as a company in Indonesia were around whether we actually put enough effort into understanding that we needed a social licence to close an operation for exactly the kind of sustainability issues that David mentioned. And so within that, the employee views of all that are absolutely huge, really important component of a strategy.
Hi, I'm Kylie Ahern from Cosmos magazine, which is a science magazine. I just want to know, how do you engage the science community? You've probably got in-house sciences, Christine, Natalie, you've probably got people who specialise in the fields you're in, but how, in order to create a truly environmental approach to your organisation, how do you engage with the greater science community and the experts who can talk about climate change and the impact your individual companies are having? What's your facility? Is it through the government? Do you have a scientific advisory body? How do you look outside your company?
Well, we've actually got quite a significant research facility within the company, about 300 scientists at our global science centre and technical people spread all around. There's a huge amount of work going on, not only on how you more efficiently make big rocks little rocks and deal with harder and harder rocks, but questions around the use of cyanide, which is for the gold industry an important component in the process, but we know is a huge problem. And so the technical investment, I mean, I have to say I love working with the technical guys. I'm chairing a group on ISO 14001 at the moment and looking at sort of standardising the use of that globally. And the technical people are the most passionate about actually engaging. And one of the interesting things for me has been their ability, or the networks they have across companies and across government, that seem to be much more fluid and more kind of intellectually based in a sense. I think, so it's not hard intellectually to engage. I think then actually making the link between that and the sort of business end of it and trying to decide what the balance is. So I don't, my problem is less how do you engage people and how do you at the end go, it's, do we use best available technology, or what is the kind of right level to pitch how you actually engage with the science people? That makes for a really interesting debate about what time frame are we operating on, which is something we need to do. Go for it.
Then, okay, so if you identify blocks in your, you know, in order to become more environmental, and yeah. If you look at the coal industry, for example, they receive an enormous amount of subsidies compared to, say, solar or wind. Do you have that sort of issue? How do you resolve that with the government? Do you have areas that, you know, you identify with them that if we had more subsidies here or less subsidies in that area, that that would enable your company to be more environmentally friendly?
Look, I think you'll get both industry sector views about it and company views. I mean, in the water area, for example, where there's, you know, water's often driven by the Murray-Darling system. You've got a national debate driven by a river system in part of it. We've actually got a joint industry ministerial council body developing water guidelines for the mining industry to try and address the question of the fact that all water's not all the same. And so you've got potable water in some areas, you've got different qualities. So I'm involved in that working group, and that's quite interesting because it is both a kind of cross-company and cross-government issue. In others, I think there's a quite interesting debate, and there certainly is not one consolidated position from the mining industry on greenhouse. The thing that's happening within our company and sector, I think, is trying to get beyond Kyoto and say, let's stop arguing about whether that was the answer and actually start looking at performance. So I think there's actually a huge amount of sharing across government. I mean, I chair an advisory group for the Sustainable Minerals Institute at Queensland Uni, which is a mixture of industry, academe and government people. So I think when you get into a lot of these areas, you find a huge number of mechanisms that are usually cross-sectoral in nature that will deal with from particular kind of technical issues through to some of these broader debates. Water, land use, you know, all of the kind of key elements of the environmental. Global emissions is another one that I think for our country, the United Nations Environment Programme is doing quite a big push on global emissions. And for our industry, it's actually understanding what we understand about our own emissions, given we tend to measure what's regulated and we tend to measure what we sell. So we understand now as an industry, we probably have to understand everything that comes into and leaves one of our sites, which is going to take us again into that kind of broader public policy area.
From Foster's perspective, we don't have a standalone sort of engagement with the scientific community in a sort of a sense that's disembodied from the issues. It's all driven by issues. So on water, it might be water around a production site, so we're engaged in the local water management committees, etc. It might be greenhouse emissions from a production facility, so you know we engage with the CSIRO, for example, to do some research or whatever. It's issues driven.
Well, both. I mean, we're in the midst of a global energy review that we'll set up. I mean, we're a very small component of... We're gold. We're sort of largely a gold mining company and we've got no soft rock. We're hard rock miners. We're not soft rock miners. So it's a very different set of issues. And so if you ask BHP, you'd get a different set of answers. But certainly from our company, one of the things that's happened in the last probably about 3 years is actually a recognition of the huge savings that are available if you build eco-efficiency in, which is actually now driving, I think, a more structured approach to how we're developing targets rather than business unit by business unit, but getting to global programs. And so, yes, at one level or another, we've had targets in place for a whole range of things, water use, recycling, emissions, energy consumption. That's, I think, consolidating more now, but we've got a long way to go.
We've got targets for all of those sorts of issues, but the bigger effort really for the future and that we're involved in right now is actually setting meaningful measures and indicators around whole parts of our business where there are no benchmarks and there's not a lot of knowledge about, you don't need targets, you need meaningful targets. So, for example, in viticulture, what is best practice in herbicide use, water use, biodiversity indicators, for example, in vineyards? Nobody knows. No one's done the work. So a lot of what we're doing at the moment is the biggest, Australian wine company and, number one by value in the world, is actually investing in that sort of work. So we're needing to build the model on before we can make meaningful targets because we can pick them out of the air, but they are useless and it's grandstanding.